I want to speak next about the three treasures, or three jewels. Buddhist philosophy contains thousands of technical terms and hundreds of categories that spring mostly from the richly intellectual culture of India. If you look in a Buddhist dictionary under the word ten, number ten, you will find several columns, ten this and ten that. This is also true for three or seven or eight. Indian mind loves categories. We defeat our purpose in Zen by studying them in detail, but there are a few expressions and classifications that cast useful light on our practice, and we should learn these by heart. Foremost among these is the Trinity of Buddhism, the three treasures or three jewels. The Buddhist Trinity is not the threefold personality of the divine being, as the Christian Trinity is, but three aspects of the way and of our lives as Zen students. The first of these jewels is the Buddha. Of course, this refers to Shakyamuni, the enlightened one, the historical founder of our path. But it also has a far broader meaning. It includes mythological personages who preceded Shakyamuni. Seven ancient Buddhas, separated in time by thousands of kalpas. One kalpa is an eon, defined as the length of time involved in wearing down a block of stone 1 mile square by an angel who comes down once every 100 years and brushes the stone with her wings. The stone is all gone. That is one kalpa. Anyway, these mythological Buddhas are venerated today, as are the various teachers in our lineage. The sixth founding teacher, Huainan or Eno, Baso Daishi, Hyakujo, Nansen, Joshu, Unmon, and in the Japanese line, such personages as Dogen, others, Hakuin Zenji, and so on. Down to our own teachers. And of course, it includes not only these great figures, but all people who have realized their true nature, who have shaken the tree of life and death. At a deeper and much more ordinary dimension, all of us are the Buddha. We haven't realized it yet, perhaps, but this does not deny the fact. Shakyamuni exclaimed, "All beings of the universe are fully realized just as they are. We are all beings of the universe, and each of our actions, standing up, sitting down, eating, conversing, is itself the Buddha. Nothing is missing." When When Hakuin Zenji wrote in his Song of Zazen, "All beings by nature are Buddha," he used the Japanese translation of the word Buddha, hotoke. Shujo honrai hotoke nari. There is also the Japanese term butsu, which is a transliteration of Buddha and has a particular technical or sectarian reference. Hotoke means something close to the Western word gods, as in the Greek or Roman pantheons. Shibayama Zenkei Roshi, in his book Flower Does Not Talk, which, by the way, is one of those I would recommend to you, says that Hakuin Zenji was really very radical in his statement, for by using hotoke instead of butsu, or one of the compounds using butsu, he is saying, in effect, all beings by nature are gods. Can this be so? There is a folk saying in Japan, the ordinary person is the Buddha. And we find similar expressions in our Zen studies. Nansen, teacher of Joshu, said, ordinary mind is the Tao. Most people who study Zen carry on in quite ordinary lives, apparently, and avoid setting themselves apart by sprinkling their conversation with special Zen words or by behaving in any kind of exclusive manner. Does this mean that they have reduced their religion to materialism? I don't think so. It is simply a matter of viewing the reality of Buddha / ordinary beings, first from one direction and then from another. All beings by nature are Buddha. The Buddha is the ordinary person. This very body is the Buddha. But of course, our job is not to flash back and forth between extremes, but to present the unified fact of the Buddha as ordinary, ordinary as Buddha, in our daily lives. The second treasure is the Dharma. In customary Buddhist usage, Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, or in Pali, D-A-M-M-A, Dharma, is Buddhist teaching or doctrine. Thousands of books and millions of words make up the Dharma in this sense. It also means the truth of Buddhism. So when the Buddha taught, we say he turned the wheel of the Dharma. Now the word Dharma is written with the ideograph for law in Chinese. And this is true to the etymological origin of the word in Sanskrit, where it also originally meant law. By this we can understand that the Dharma is the law of the universe, the way things are, the way they behave. For the Buddhist, there is no difference between the Buddha Dharma and ordinary Dharma. Both are Dharma, now expounded by a Buddhist teacher, now by an astronomer or whoever. Not only does Dharma imply the way of things, it is also used to mean things themselves, facts themselves, for things and facts essentially are no more than their behavior. Always in motion, always acting and interacting with other things. The stone sits in the earth, and to the uninitiated eye, it may seem that that stone is altogether passive, altogether a noun, so to speak. But actually, it is a verb. It is acting and interacting with soil, with air, with rain, and with people and with animals when they come into contact. Grammatically speaking, phenomena are not nouns, but verbs. There is no such thing in nature as a noun. There is in grammar, but not in nature. Everything is verb or adverb, action and pertaining to action. Now, this leads us, of course, into the law of karma, because this is the law of cause and effect. This is the law of action. Karma means action. What is the nature of action? It comes from a cause and has an effect. This law of the universe is inviolable, but it is not kismet. In the way we understand kismet, you know, fate in the Muslim sense. I'm not sure that kismet is understood this way all the time, you know, that it all Muslims interpret kismet as fate in the event of something bad, punishment for our sins. But to some degree it is regarded in this way. However, you should understand karma as, for your own karma, something that has happened in the past, something that has brought you here. But there are an infinite number of karmic factors in your background. And you need not be confined to a single line reaction to any of them. You hear a lot about being free from your karma. Please understand the meaning here clearly. Being free from your karma does not mean you are free from karma. That is to say, you live in a world of cause and effect. But being free of that means that you are free within your own sphere of karma to choose that appropriate line of karmic influence that is appropriate for this time and place. If your mother beat you when you were a little child, that does not mean that you need to beat your child. That's what I mean. See? People who are victims of their karma are hung up on one aspect of their karma. One or two or a few particular lines of their own karma. Regard yourself as the center of your own sphere, you see, and behind you are 180 degrees, not merely on a single plane, but above and below, in every direction, millions and millions of influences in your own background. So So that, in effect, you have infinite choice for your action in the present toward the future. You need not stay here. As I said yesterday, you can pick up your towel and go to the beach. It's a nice day. There is, you should also understand, you know, that within your own sphere, there are certain limitations. If you are a man, you cannot bear a child. If you are a human being, you cannot metabolize grass. There is, of course, a natural limitation. I can no longer be 20 years old. I cannot become 5 feet 6 inches tall again. There is also something very mysterious about karma. During the Vietnam War, two men from the island of Hawaii, in the state of Hawaii, were sent to war, to Vietnam. They were twins. They were placed in different outfits, and they both stepped on landmines. One of them lost his right leg, and the other lost his left leg. And when you reflect that between identical twins, one is right-handed and the other is left-handed, you begin to wonder, you know, where does free will stop and fate begin? There is something tantalizingly mysterious about karma. In Japanese, there is the expression "fushigi na en," mysterious karma. And we must not be hung up on the possibilities of karma, but also we must acknowledge that what we say and what we do will have effects throughout all time. There is another saying in Japan that if you are walking in a crowd and you brush the sleeve of someone else accidentally, that action has had its roots in the mysterious past and will have its effects in the infinite future. Okay. It's all right. Let him come up. Come, kitty. Come. You should also understand that karma is only a word. I remember we brought a monk from Japan many years ago to the Diamond Sangha in Hawaii, and his first words and his first meeting was, in his imperfect English, "I came here because of the law of karma." That's not true, you see. The apple didn't fall beside Newton because of the law of gravity, you see. It fell because it was ripe. Do you see the distinction here? Once someone said to me, "You know, there's a Freudian basis for falls. In other words, there's a Freudian reason for falling down." I said, "You mean you fall down because you want to?" And she said, "Oh no, that's not what I mean at all." See? Somehow she was blaming Sigmund Freud for falling down. See? This is how we get caught up with concepts. Concepts are made to be used, but all too often we are used by concepts. So when you say the words, "It's my karma," see, reflect a moment. Are you blaming your activity on that word? See? It's also your responsibility. So understanding that that karma is just a word helps us to understand that there is no such thing as cause and effect as separate entities. Everything is a cause. Everything is an effect. Everything is neither. The acts, anybody's act, you see, is full and complete in itself.